Pro-Russia separatists in several parts of Ukraine will hold referendums on joining Russia in the coming days. British Prime Minister Liz Truss announcing yet another major military aid to Ukraine for next year. Also in the headlines, the UN chief warning of a looming winter of discontent in a world beset by multiple crises, from the Ukraine war to a warming climate. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Bashar Sanjafi. Good to have you with us. Now, starting with developments regarding Ukraine and Russia, pro-Russia separatists in several Ukrainian regions saying that they will hold referendums on joining Russia in the coming days. The self-proclaimed Luhansk People's Republic passed a law earlier on Tuesday outlining details of the proposed vote. Russian media have cited sources saying that a vote is set to take place between September 23rd and 27th. The self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic also plans a vote on secession from Ukraine in the coming days. Authorities in the Russian-controlled southern Kherson region and southeastern Zaporizhia region also say that they will hold similar referendums not later than September the 27th. Moscow says it's up to the residents of those regions to decide if they want to be part of Russia.
From the very beginning of the special military operation, and before that, we've been saying that the peoples of the prospective territories should decide their own fate. The whole current situation confirms that they want to be master of their own fate.
The coordinated moves have sparked Kiev's angry reaction, with the government pledging to, quote, eliminate Moscow's threat. The Ukrainian foreign minister says the proposed referendums will not change anything on the ground. In 2014, the Crimea Peninsula formally broke away from Ukraine and joined Russia, following a referendum. Now let's have an update regarding the fighting in Ukraine. Government forces there have advanced further into the east, reclaiming more areas from Russian troops. A video posted on social media shows Ukrainian soldiers walking on a road in Bilohorivka after regaining control of the area just west of the Russian held city of Lysychansk. According to Ukrainian officials, the soldiers are now in full control of the area and preparing to retake the entire Luhansk province. Ukrainian troops have launched a counteroffensive in the eastern region since driving Russian forces out of northeastern Kharkiv province early this month. Meantime, the Russian Defense Ministry says its forces have destroyed an armored vehicle repair plant in southern Ukraine. Now, the UK is doubling down on its support for Ukraine, with Prime Minister Liz Truss pledging to provide at least another $2.6 billion in military aid to Kiev next year. Truss also described Ukrainian forces' recent advances as inspirational. Truss, who is in New York for the UN General Assembly session, also pledged to rally support for Ukraine at the event. The UK is already the second largest military donor to Ukraine after the US. London has supplied Kiev with weapons including long-range rockets, anti-tank missiles, and air defense systems. Britain is also training Ukrainian military on the field. Robert Carter earlier told us that London's decision as regards the war in Ukraine would directly affect the lives of Britons.
Of course, I mean, that arguably is one of the main reasons why the West in general tends to be very interested in basically what's been described by others as a death economy, keep war abroad going so that we can make a profit from that and keep our wealth in the Western world, at least the wealth within the establishment, going very strong. Of course, there are major arms firms which are going to benefit tremendously from ongoing conflict in Ukraine. We've seen Western arms manufacturers benefit greatly from a long and pointless, totally avoidable war in Yemen, for example. So, of course, there are going to be major benefactors from ongoing crisis in Ukraine. But the fact of the matter is that the ordinary British person is beginning to have direct consequences to their living standards as a result of this particular conflict. And that's why I think it is being looked at differently in comparison to, say, conflicts which Britain and America have supported for a long time in other parts of the world, like Africa and in the Middle East and so on.
Staying with the UK, the government is in trouble again over the ongoing cost of living crisis. A federation of trade unions launching legal action against the new law that allows the government to replace striking workers with other staff. Union umbrella group TUC, along with other unions, is set to challenge the government's decision to court. They argue that the right to strike is a fundamental British liberty. They say restricting the freedom to strike is a breach of international law. Workers across various sectors have gone on strike across Britain since summer as decades-high inflation erodes their earnings. The government of former Prime Minister Boris Johnson then amended the law to fill gaps caused by strikes. Then those elections are set to resume over the next couple of weeks, including railway workers over pay, job security, and working conditions. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has opened the 77th session of General Assembly in New York with a stark warning to international leaders that the world is grappling with multiple crises.
Excellencies, we need action across the board. Let's have no illusions. We are in rough seas. A winter of global discontent is on the horizon. A cost of living crisis is raging. Trust is crumbling. Inequalities are exploding. And our planet is burning. People are hurting, with the most vulnerable suffering the most.
Now, this is the first in-person gathering of world leaders at the 193-member General Assembly after 2 years of COVID restrictions. The UN chief stressed that cooperation and dialogues are the only path forward, adding that no power or group alone can call the shots. He said geopolitical divides have made the world unable to tackle major challenges threatening the future of humanity. Guterres also pointed out that the dire state of the planet lashing out at fossil fuel companies. The war in Ukraine and mounting economic and environmental crisis are on top of the agenda during this year's UN General Assembly meeting. Okay, now let's go to the UN, and we have our own man, Ramin Mazahiri, is now in New York, close to the UN headquarters. Ramin, so we just got on the way, UN General Assembly, the 77th one. And we had the opening speech. Tell us about it.
Well, it's the first time the UN has met in the last 3 years. Certainly, there has been plenty of turmoil in the world since then. There are a lot of world leaders who are not here, including U.S. President Joe Biden. Biden is getting some criticism for that he is missing a real opportunity for internationalism in order to worship at the feet of the former master of the United States, whom the United States had a revolution against. However, moving on. Today we had the start of the General Assembly with the Secretary General Guterres. He was mostly harping on about the climate crisis, but more than that, he was talking about how the entire world right now is having so many problems, and this is really what other people are going to focus on, namely Russia, food security, inflation. And this is something that Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi mentioned yesterday, that really all of these problems, they are caused by unilateralism. And we are here at the UN, which is the essence of the absolute contrary of the idea of unilateralism, which is internationalism, multilateralism, mutually beneficial cooperation. However, many countries here, they really believe that the United Nations is something that is dominated by Western powers. And many of the Western powers and the Western journalists, they will hopefully learn by the end of this week when it comes to topics like Russia, where here at the UN, the overwhelming majority of countries voted not to condemn Russia for their war with Ukraine that has been going on since 2014. That vote, hopefully many journalists here will remember. Only the English-speaking countries and Europe voted to condemn Russia. However, during this week, it's certainly expected that all of the Western leaders will use their speeches as a chance to really bash Russia and really condemn them, even though it is their unilateral rejection of the Minsk Accords and something that has been in place, and there's a process that has been placed since 2014 that has led to the very, very tragic results today in Ukraine. Tomorrow, Iranian President Raisi will speak. Thursday, he will have a press conference, and he's going to have bilateral meetings all this week. He has rejected meeting with U.S. President Biden, who is due here to speak tomorrow. But hopefully, many people, many leaders, and many press, and many observers will be reminded of what Raisi quite correctly stressed, that this is a place for internationalism, for multilateral cooperation, and not for unilateral action such as sanctions and other weapons of war.
Okay, that's right. You know, list of problems are there, but the thing is that they should join hands to see if this is going to happen. Thank you for that, Ryan Mazahir. Keep an eye on what's happening there. We'll come back to it at a later time. Ryan Mazahir, our correspondent at the United Nations headquarters in New York. Iranian President Rahim Raisi is in New York City to attend the 77th UN General Assembly Summit. Now, the significance of the trip is not just about Iran's presence at the UN, but rather Iran addressing the world from a position of strength. Now, perhaps at no other time in history has the West appeared to be in a weaker position compared to Iran, that has placed diplomacy at the heart of its foreign policy.
When it comes to Iran and the UN General Assembly this year, one of the questions asked was whether the Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi would meet and talk with the U.S. President Joe Biden. The answer was pretty clear.
You're off to New York. You're going to speak at the United Nations. You know, President Biden is going to be there. Are you open to a meeting with President Biden, a face-to-face?
No, I don't think that such a meeting would happen. I don't believe having a meeting or talk with him will be beneficial.
But this issue should not be the focus, because Iran's presence at this year's assembly means so much more than just whether Raisi will meet Biden or not. So much has changed since Ibrahim Raisi spoke at last year's UNGA.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Iran is the land of culture and civilization.
The transformation of Iran from just a year ago to the current Islamic Republic today is quite remarkable, especially on the international arena. But how has Iran changed? For example, Ibrahim Raisi has been able to turn the table when it comes to harsh and cruel U.S. bilateral sanctions. His administration has turned Iran's economy around, with Iran's GDP and foreign trade to have increased. No easy task when it comes to it being executed. Another example, he kept true to his word and did not link Iran's economic challenges or progress to the JCPOA revival or sanctions removal talks. That has had an impact on an international level, since he showed in action that economic problems could be solved without a deal with the U.S. and some Western countries. Furthermore, when it comes to negotiations, Iran is not negotiating from a weak economic position. An economy that is rebounding strongly, it has beaten the maximum pressure campaign that the U.S. exerted on it. The important achievements of this administration can be seen here. They have elevated Iran's standing not only domestically, but also on the world stage. And the reason why this is important is because it flies smack in the face of U.S. and Western sanctions, showing how Iran can withstand these unilateral coercive measures and progress at the same time.
Okay, let's move on. Russia has urged Armenia and Azerbaijan to resolve their territorial disputes via negotiations, and that's while fighting flaring up again between the two southern Caucasian neighbors.
I emphasize that we are seriously concerned about any conflict situations between states that are close to us. We call on everyone to show restraint, to observe the ceasefire strictly, and to firmly follow the trilateral statements by the leaders of Russia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia.
The Russian president made a comment in a televised speech. The fighting between Armenian and Azerbaijani forces first erupted last week. The two former Soviet republics have reported more than 200 fatalities. The two neighbors are bitter rivals. They have been clashing over ethnical and territorial issues since late 1980s. Last week, a ceasefire put a temporary stop to the bloodshed. The latest clashes are the deadliest since the 2020 war that was ended with a Russia-brokered truce. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement has lashed out at the U.S. and the Saudi-led coalition over their meddling in his country's internal affairs. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said that the interference has reached an extent where Washington and Riyadh decide the formation of governments and the selection of ministers in areas held by former government loyalists. He says even a council management is selected by the Americans and Saudis. Al-Houthi noted that actions of the U.S. ambassador to Yemen is a flagrant violation of the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. He said that the U.S. has been pursuing the goal of partitioning Yemen. Those comments were made in an event commemorating the 8th anniversary of the ouster of Saudi-backed former president Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi. Ethiopia's flashpoint northern Tigray region is heading for yet another conflict. A local paramilitary group accuses neighboring Eritrea of launching a full-scale offensive in border areas. Spokesman for the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, says that Ethiopian government troops have also joined the offensive. Neither Eritrean nor Ethiopian government officials have responded to the allegations. Tigray plunged into bloodshed 2 years ago after the federal government launched a war on forces loyal to TPLF. Addis Ababa then imposed a blockade on the region after rebels refused to pull out of the areas that they'd captured in Afar and Amhara regions. Months of fighting left hundreds of people dead and tens of thousands more displaced. A ceremony has been held in the Syrian capital city to honor journalists who lost their lives during the years-long war in the Arab country. Mohammed Ali has a report from Damascus.
Syria's Ministry of Information organized an event to pay tribute to journalists who were killed while covering the war on the country. Syrian officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, technicians, and other workers in the media sector.
The martyrs of media are the true heroes on battlefields alongside the Syrian Arab Army. They will remain alive in our memory. Meeting their families is a great honor because they represent truly an example of strength and loyalty to the homeland. We are honoring them today to thank them for their great sacrifices.
Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation expressing how proud they are that their family members' blood was one of the main reasons for Syria's victory over terrorism. Press TV's correspondent Maya Nasser was also among the list of journalists who lost their lives during the Syrian conflict. He was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He is one of many journalists who was keen on always being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. Despite knowing the dangers of reporting on battlefields, many journalists risked their lives to report on the truth of events. Tens were killed or injured, defending the principles of journalism and showing responsibility in conveying what was truly happening on the ground in the face of a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
in the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard that 10 days after Imam Khomeini is going to Kuwait from Iraq and then leaving Kuwait immediately for France, his wife and family made preparations to join him in Paris. Before going to Paris, they held the martyrdom anniversary of the Imam's elder son, Haj Aqa Mustafa, and 4 days later left for Paris. Stay tuned for the rest of the story. The arrival of Imam Khomeini's wife, Lady Khadija Saqafi, in Paris was amazing and interesting to those who met her, as she was acquainted with French language. Haj Ahmad and some of the friends had come to the airport to welcome her. There was a student among them by the name of Nasrin Hakami, who was studying postgraduate in sociology. When the car carrying Miss Saqafi entered the streets of Paris, she started reading the signs. Some of her co-travelers were surprised, and Ms. Hakami asked her if she knew French. The Imam's wife answered that she had learned it before high school and continued, ironically, "Yet you shouldn't expect me to help you with your lessons." In those days, many religious families were opposed to women's education outside homes. The polite and solemn behavior of Ms. Saqafi attracted the neighbors and people in Neuf-le-Château village in the outskirts of Paris. She used to stand up for guests and foresee them up the exit door. When the visitors saw her respectful, sincere, and plain conduct, they would be astonished and ask if she was the wife of the man who had staged a revolution in the world. Lady Khadija Saqafi, besides warm welcome and hospitality towards guests, used to answer their questions quiet, calmly, and patiently. This would make people interested in her, and they would become curious to know more about Imam Khomeini and his movement. One of the women who had met Imam Khomeini's wife describes her as follows. She looked very stylish in the chocolate coat and skirt, which was set with her cream shirt. She had a flowery chador on her shoulders with a headscarf which was fit with her coat and shirt. She was sitting on the ground, and we asked her to sit on the chair. She said, "It would be very bad if you sit on the ground while I'm sitting on the chair." At last, our insistence made her to sit on the chair, but the shame on her face showed her humbleness and plainness very well. Some of the visitors would ask political questions from the Imam's wife. This would make it a little difficult, as she had to answer the questions on the one hand, while avoiding answers which would cause the despotic regime in Iran to misuse the answers. Thus, she would answer some of the questions subtly and smartly. Sometimes she would say with a smile, "I am a political scholar's wife and not he himself." Some of the questions were about possible differences in her life with the Imam. She would answer like this: "Both the Imam and I reach an agreement in many differences, as we recognize differences of opinion, and very rarely do we dispute." Once she was asked if she was worried as her security was threatened, she answered, "Firstly, security is related with feeling. A part of it is real, while another part is the feeling that cowardly people would feel even if with 100 guards. Thank God the Imam is so brave that there is no fear in our house in the light of his bravery.
Moreover, naturally, I am not a coward. Imam Khomeini's wife enjoyed lofty characteristics like her husband, and she didn't have any personal grudge against the Shah and his family. Thus, when the Shah was escaping from the country, she was impressed. Late Ms. Marzieh Hadidchi Dabbagh, who was in Paris in the last month of the Imam's stay, narrated an interesting account on this. The day when the Shah went, the sounds of people's joy and the slogans of death to the Shah were heard. The people in Neuville-le-Château, too, were happy. But when I said good night to the lady, Miss Safi, she was calm and quiet. And the next morning when she got up, there was no sign of joy in her face. I told her something to make her laugh. I said, "Lady, I congratulate you as the Shah has gone," she said. "We should congratulate you as you have been tortured in the prisons of Savak. But I wish this did not happen. I wish he had listened to the Imam's words in 1962 and had come to the nation so that he would not lose his popular support while going under the yoke of superpowers. I do not express happiness for the evil fate of anyone. I wish he had not become a Shah in the beginning and would not hear the chants of death to Shah these days. When I think of what a hard night he and his wife Farah are going to pass, I don't know what to say. I hope they will not commit any evil deed from now on so that their load of sins becomes heavier."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is the member you are listening to. May Allah accept your mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Today we invite you to listen to an English lecture by Brother Amin Rastani.
We started a topic and I wasn't able to finish it last night. Inshallah tonight we will finish it. And I will go over just the main points that I covered last night as well, inshallah. And that had to do with this whole idea of, okay, we see Imam Hussein, what he did has lasted till today. Nothing can get in the way of it. And when we look around us, we see that there's a lot going on, but why is it that there's one thing out there that has lasted this long? Other things similar to it don't last long. They haven't lasted long. His turbana. I want to share a couple hadith about his turba. The sand, or as they call it, the khaki shifa of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. It says here that Bibi Fatima salawatullahi wa salamu alayha says that she kanat subhatuha min khuyuti sufin mufattalin. She had a tasbih. But look at how her tasbih was back then, her subha, right? It was a yarn, let's call it, that she had made knots in. So those are like lumps that you have in the yarn so you can count. And so it's 34 knots. If there's any mustahab, I would suggest, brothers and sisters, you know, the little stuff that goes a long way, this is one of them. Tasbihat al-Zahra, okay? 34 times Allahu Akbar, 33 times Alhamdulillah, 33 times Subhanallah after every wajib salat. Don't miss out on it. those little things that make a big difference sometimes. Anyway, she would use that. But then when Hamza Sayyidu Shuhada becomes Shaheed, it says that she made a subha from his, from the dust of his grave. And then it goes on to say that after Imam Hussein was killed, the people who were following this sunnat of Bibi Fatima, they shifted over to Imam Hussein because of the benefits that the dust of Imam Hussein has. Well, what are those? So people have asked, in other hadith we find this. It says that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was asked, عن استعمال التربتين. He was asked, which one of the two should we use? The turba from Imam Hussein alayhi salam or from Hamza Sayyidu Shuhada? Look at the wording. Look at how beautiful he answers. He doesn't say this one's better than the other. He just mentions one of the benefits of Imam Hussein's turba. It's just beautiful. He says, look, الصبح التي من طين قبر الحسين تسبح بيد الرجل من غير أن يسبح. Let me just tell you that this tasbih that is made from the turba of Imam Hussein does tasbih and glorification of Allah even if the person is not actually doing that. So you do the math, the ukhrawi math. I personally believe that, yeah, I mean, alhamdulillah, today we have access to have these tasbihs in your home. These fidget things that kids have and whatever's, man, I was thinking about it, like, even they got us even there, guys. They got us even there. You know why? Look at this next hadith. من عن الصادق عليه السلام قال من أدار صبحة من تربة الحسين مرة واحدة بالاستغفار أو غيره كتب الله له 70 مرة. If a person takes this tasbih and says an istighfar with it, it multiplies by 70. The tasbih of Imam Hussein. The tasbih of that's come from the turba of Imam Hussein. And the sajda on it tears the seven veils. Then they've explained that means that this salat makes its way up, inshallah. But when I say fidget stuff, it's because of this one right here. What if I'm not saying anything with it, I'm just holding on to it, and I'm just playing with it? Now the wording isn't playing, it says adara, meaning turning it. You know, have you seen these lecturers, they're always holding a tasbih, and they're like, as they're speaking, I can't do that, but I don't know, but they're like, they're also, you know, moving the tasbih beads, right? Well, don't use a plastic one at least. Use a turba one. Because of this hadith, it says, man adara al-hajar من تربة الحسين فاستغفر به مرة كتب الله له 70 times. وإن أمسك الصبح بيه. If this person is holding it ولم يسبح ففي كل حبة منها 7 مرات. So if I'm saying ذكر multiply by 70 استغفار. If I'm not saying anything, I'm holding it, multiply each bead by 7. Those people who are big on math. 7. Multiply each one by 7. Okay? So this is with the turba. You see, this is what I was talking about last night. When we say, okay, Allah's will, Allah has willed this. Well, how is he going to make it big with these things? Who else can do this? If the whole entire world comes to us and says, you know what? The dust from Dallas like is special. We're not going to care. Right? We're not going to care. Why? It's if Allah says it, we know, okay, this is going to really happen. There's something in it here. And he's promising us these things. And finally, his ziyara, the shrine of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. There are two hadiths here. Let me see if I can go through both or if I can have to just go through one of them. It says that, this is just one hadith of many hadiths, and you've heard both of them, I think, because they're very famous, that there are 4,000 angels inda qabr al-Hussein. 4,000 angels next to the grave of Hussein. Shu'thun ghubrun, disheveled. And dusty. Of course, it's figurative. Because angels don't have bodies. But it's just illustrating for us the state of these angels. يَبْكُونَهُ إِلَىٰ يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ Weeping for him until the day of judgment. So those who go to Karbala, yes, they are with the angels. But who cares about the angels when Imam Hussein is there? رَئِيسُهُمْ مَلَكٌ يُقَالُ لَهُ مَنْصُورٌ Their head is an angel by the name of Mansur. And so this is the cool part. It says, so a za'ir will not do ziyara and visit that grave except that they receive this individual. Sometimes you think you're going there, the angels are probably doing their thing, let me do my thing. No. They are opening their arms and wings to you, as if, and welcoming you. And with that will come a lot of blessing. وَلَا يُوَدِّعُهُ مُوَدِّعُ. And people don't leave Imam Hussein except that these people come to bid them, these angels come to bid them farewell. This person doesn't fall ill except that these angels come and visit that person. This person, when he passes away or she passes away, they come and they do salat over them as well, and so on. So these kinds of things are what keep it alive. And finally, this last hadith, let me go through it very quickly. It says that someone came to Imam al-Sadiq to visit him. They said, okay, go in. He goes in, he sees the Imam is praying. So he waits. And then he notices that the Imam, after his prayer, he is doing a dua. So what is he saying? I'm going to read parts of it. He says, O Allah, O Lord, forgive the visitors of the grave of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn, who spend their wealth, those who ready their bodies due to their interest in doing good to us and because of their hope in what is with you of compensation, for keeping good relations with us, and because of the happiness they bring to the heart of your Prophet. I appeal before Allah to grant salawat and forgive them because of their yielding to our commands. In other words, they're going to ziyarah because of us. And because of the anger due to their visit, they cause to our enemies. So it makes the Imam happy. So compensate them on our behalf by being happy with them. Support them in the night and day. Be their deputy in their families and children whom they have left behind. When you leave your family, you go for ziyarah, you're worried. Oh Allah, take care of those families. Accompany them. It goes on and on and on. It reaches this part. So be kind, O Allah, to the faces which the heat of the sun has changed. Back then, yes, no air conditioning. It takes a long time to go for ziyarah. The sun will be beating down on your face when you go. And it will maybe discolor you, disfigure you for a little bit, whatever it is. Oh Allah, have mercy on these faces. Imam Ali, he would do good deeds. He would sometimes, they say, put himself in very hard situations and circumstances. Fire is like blowing from a furnace or something in his face. He says, it's okay, let this be the fire instead of the fire of Jahannam. He's teaching us. Yes, it comes with sacrifice. Jannah comes with sacrifice. Whether it was the Imam making bread for people or whatever it was. Be kind to the faces which the heat of the sun has changed. Be kind to the side of the faces, the cheeks which are turned from side to side over the grave of Abu Abdullah. Yes. You go to Haram. Alhamdulillah, before COVID, I got to go once with the Al-Asr group. Man, I was there for hours just putting my face, this cheek, that cheek. You just stand there, you recite poetry to Imam Hussein. What, I mean... Be kind to those eyes which have shed tears in sympathy with us. Be kind to the hearts which mourned and felt pain for us. And the Imam goes on and on. It's beautiful. It's the dua of the Imam is beautiful in this regard.
Oh, Hussein, you live forever. To Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The American people are still struggling with rising costs, and the situation isn't going to change anytime in the near future. We have prepared for you an article written by Gene Marks. The piece is titled, U.S. Inflation Isn't Going Away. Small businesses must plan ahead. According to a report recently issued by the U.S. National Federation of Independent Businesses, inflation is the top challenge facing small businesses this year, with a whopping 91% admitting that rising prices are having either a substantial or a moderate impact on their companies. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce says that nearly 7 in 10 small businesses have raised prices to cope with inflation, which is also considered their dominating challenge. 65% of small business respondents in a Goldman Sachs study said rising input costs have forced them to raise the price of their goods and services this year, with almost 80% saying the economy has gotten worse over the past 3 months. U.S. officials claim if Americans are having inflationary challenges in their business, they're not alone. However, they say there is some good news for them. And, unfortunately, some bad news as well. The good news is that inflation appears to be plateauing. They claim prices for core materials such as industrial chemicals, construction supplies, copper, aluminium, plastics, packaging, iron and steel, and even agriculture products like fertilizer and processed feeds are either leveling off or not rising quickly. The price of lumber products has dropped significantly from their highs last year. Oil prices are down 30% from earlier this summer. But this is partly because the world's supply chain is beginning to show signs of normalcy. Port traffic in Long Beach, California is down to 84 ships off the coast, significantly less than during the pandemic. Mass lockdowns in China have ended, and the Baltic Dry Index, a key measure of freight costs and shipping demand, has fallen almost 30% since the beginning of the year. There's also been a general slowdown in the world's demand for goods, which, while not great, has certainly affected prices. It's doubtful whether the Democrats' Inflation Reduction Act, regardless of the positive impact it should have on our climate and healthcare problems, will have much impact on inflation. Penn's Wharton School says that the bill would actually increase inflation until 2024 and has low confidence that the legislation will have any impact on inflation. But officials claim the good news is that government spending has significantly decreased, and the U.S. Federal Reserve is no longer pouring fuel on the fire. This brings me to the bad news. We're still struggling with rising costs, and the situation isn't going to change anytime in the near future. Producer prices at 11.3% as of June are still up well over historical levels. And because the producer price index is considered a leading indicator, that means that ultimately consumer prices will remain at elevated levels for months to come. It took a year and a half for inflation to reach these levels. Consumer prices began rising in March 2021 and hit 7% by the end of 2021, well before Russia's special operation in Ukraine. It's going to take at least that long for it to return to the more sustainable levels we've seen in the past. It may take even longer. That's because there are lots of obstacles in the way of significantly taming inflation. Some economists, notably former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, believed the Federal Reserve's moves aren't aggressive enough. Further pressure from the Ukraine conflict could elevate energy and food prices, particularly as we head into the winter months. More COVID cases in China could once again disrupt the supply chain. Even if the world economy begins to grow significantly again in the near future, that growth could put strains on U.S. fragile supply chains and disrupt pricing for many of the core materials Americans buy. What is clear is that when and if prices do start to fall, it is going to take time, and in some sectors, a lot more time than in others. Nor is declining overall inflation a guarantee that prices will not rise in some areas again. The energy sector, particularly gasoline prices, have played a huge role in soaring inflation rates. Compared to last year, energy prices were up 41% in June, and gas prices alone were up 60%. According to federal government statistics, Americans are using less gas this summer. Gas consumption in the United States is now over 1 million barrels a day, below levels that were seen in the summer of 2020, which was already lower than what was seen pre-pandemic. Despite falling demand, it is still unclear how long the low gas prices will last. The energy market is extremely volatile. Some analysts have warned that gas prices could go up again in the fall as stricter sanctions against Russian oil are set to start in December. The OPEC cartel of oil-producing nations agreed to an increase in oil output that is seemingly in a snub to Joe Biden, their smallest increase ever. Like the energy market, the food sector is highly volatile as well, as it is also sensitive to geopolitical relations and climate. The food index increased 10.9% over the last year, the largest 12-month increase since the period ending May of 1979. A number of factors went into the rising food prices, including a highly infectious avian flu that wiped out many chickens across the country. Tyson Foods, one of the largest meat producers in America, said that labor shortages and higher grain prices played a role in rising meat prices. The pandemic induced a shortage of semiconductor chips, which are used in everything from phones to television sets to cars, that is still being seen today. The shortage is squeezing the car industry. Analysts are predicting that the low number of new car sales, which dropped 12% year over year in July, will continue throughout to the end of summer as the supply of cars continues to be sparse. According to Cox Automotive, the average price for a new car hit a record $48,000 in June. In July, Americans were paying 10.4% more for new vehicles and 6.6% more for used cars compared with the year before. That's a dramatic fall from earlier this year. In January, used cars were 44.6% higher than they were at the start of 2021. But it still means prices are rising and from a high base. Though the chip shortage does not affect the used car market directly, fewer new cars means that people are holding on to their cars rather than buying new ones. The Senate just passed a bipartisan bill that provides $52 billion in subsidies to chip manufacturers in the United States and investment into developing a more robust domestic chip industry, though any impact from the bill on the car industry will not be seen for some time. Though used car prices showed signs of easing earlier in the summer, they still remain historically high and will probably remain so for the near future. Economists argue that it is possible that inflation has hit its peak, and there are signs that many of the pressure behind inflation are easing, but it is still hard to predict the path that inflation will take. Some of the prices being seen today, like for gas and homes, will probably continue to go down, but other costs will, in the best-case scenario, stay put. The process of turning inflation is unpleasant. Fewer people can afford to buy houses or new cars, and businesses have less money to expand. But getting inflation down is necessary for the economy to get back to a healthy balance between supply and demand.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyya on August 30th, 2022. When the president returned from his trip abroad, he immediately went to Kirman to visit those who have been affected by the floods. His minister also spent several days monitoring the work that was being done. These are important matters. This is one of your accomplishments. It shows the administration's empathy towards people and their presence on the field to get the job done. This is an accomplishment. I'm not mentioning these accomplishments just to praise you. What I'm trying to say is that you shouldn't give up on this kind of work. Make sure you don't stop doing this. Keep it up.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
And another accomplishment you've made is that you've removed all negative competition from the relations between the three powers, executive, judicial, and legislative systems. I believe this is an important matter. It is bad for the government, the parliament, and the judicial to constantly clash with each other and complain. Such actions worry people. Today we feel there is agreement and that a kind of empathy exists. Of course, this part and this work is one of the things that both the government and the parliament must take care of and maintain. It is a fragile matter. This is one of the things that is not really in your control or in the parliament's control. Certain individuals may come and create commotion and create sedition among you. You need to try and preserve this empathy and consensus. The government, the parliament, and the judiciary all need to be mindful of this. You need to be careful. Another of your achievements has been your employing the youth in the country's executive sectors. This is a great move, for it opens the worn-out circle of managers, replacing them with a new force.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.